only 50% of the time. See opposite page bottom. This method works well for weather forecasts because there is new weather every day and forecasts stack up fast. But it works less well for events like presidential elections because it would take centuries undisturbed by wars, plagues, and other shocks that perturb the true underlying causes to pile up enough forecasts to make the statistics work. A little creativity can help. We could focus on the state level in presidential elections, for example, which would give us 50 results per election, not one. But we still have a problem. The many forecasts required for calibration calculations make it impractical to judge forecasts about rare events. And even with common events, it means we must be patient data collectors and cautious data interpreters. Important as calibration is, it's not the whole story because perfect calibration isn't what we think of when we imagine perfect forecasting accuracy. Perfection is godlike omniscience. It's saying, this will happen, and it does, or this won't happen, and it doesn't. The technical term for this is resolution. The two figures on page 63 show how calibration and resolution capture distinct facets of good judgment. The figure on top represents perfect calibration, but poor resolution. It's perfect calibration because when the forecaster says there's a 40% chance something will happen, it happens 40% of the time. And when she says there is a 60% chance that something will happen, it happens 60% of the time. But it's poor resolution because the forecaster never strays out of the minor shades of maybe zone between 40% and 60%. The figure on the bottom represents superb calibration and resolution. Again, the calibration is superb because forecasts happen as often as they should. 40% calls happen 40% of the time. But this time, the forecaster is much more decisive and does a great job of assigning high probabilities to things that happen and low probabilities to things that don't. When we combine calibration and resolution, we get a scoring system that fully captures our sense of what good forecasters should do. Someone who says there is a 70% chance of X should do fairly well if X happens. But someone who says there is a 90% chance of X should do better. And someone bold enough to correctly predict X with 100% confidence gets top marks. But hubris must be punished. The forecaster who says X is a slam dunk should take a big hit if X does not happen. How big a hit is debatable, but it's reasonable to think of it in betting terms. If I say it is 80% likely that the Yankees will beat the Dodgers, and I am willing to put a bet on it, I am offering you 4-to-1 odds. If you take my bet and put in $100 on it, you will pay me $100 if the Yankees win, and I will pay you $400 if the Yankees lose. But if I say the probability of a Yankees victory is 90%, I've upped the odds to 9-to-1. If I say a win is 95% likely, I put the odds at 19-to-1. That's extreme. If you agree to bet $100, I will owe you $1,900 if the Yankees lose. Our scoring system for forecasting should capture that pain. The math behind this system was developed by Glenn W. Breyer in 1950. Hence, results are called Breyer scores. In effect, Breyer scores measure the distance between what you forecast and what actually happened. So Breyer scores are like golf scores, lower is better. Perfection is zero. A hedged 50-50 call, or random guessing, in the aggregate, will produce a Breyer score of 0.5. A forecast that is wrong to the greatest possible extent, saying there is a 100% chance that something will happen and it doesn't every time, scores a disastrous 2.0, as far from the truth as it is possible to get. So we've come a long way. We have forecasting questions with clearly defined terms and timelines. We have lots of forecasts with numbers and the math to calculate scores. We have squeezed out as much ambiguity as appears humanly possible. We're ready to march into the new enlightenment, right? The meaning of the math. Not quite. Remember, the whole point of this exercise is to judge the accuracy of forecasts so we can then figure out what works in forecasting and what doesn't. To do that, we have to interpret the meaning of the Brier scores, which requires two more things: benchmarks and comparability. Let's suppose we discover that you have a Brier score of 0.2. That's far from godlike omniscience, 0, but a lot better than chimp-like guessing, 0.5. So it falls in the range of what one might expect from, say, a human being. But we can say much more than that. What a Brier score means depends on what's being forecast. For instance, it's quite easy to imagine circumstances where a Brier score of 0.2 would be disappointing. Consider the weather in Phoenix, Arizona. Each June, it gets very hot and sunny. A forecaster who followed a mindless rule like, always assign 100% to hot and sunny, would get a Brier score close to zero, leaving 0.2 in the dust. Here, the right test of skill would be whether a forecaster can do better than mindlessly predicting no change. This is an underappreciated point. For example, after the 2012 presidential election, Nate Silver, Princeton's Sam Wang, and other poll aggregators were hailed for correctly predicting all 50 state outcomes. But almost no one noted that a crude across-the-board prediction of no change, if a state went Democratic or Republican in 2008, it will do the same in 2012, would have scored 48 out of 50, which suggests that many excited exclamations of, "He called all 50 states," we heard at the time, were a tad overwrought. Fortunately, poll aggregators are pros. They know that improving predictions tends to be a game of inches. Another key benchmark is other forecasters. Who can beat everyone else? Who can beat the consensus forecast? How do they pull it off? Answering these questions requires comparing Brier scores, which in turn requires a level playing field. Forecasting the weather in Phoenix is just plain easier than forecasting the weather in Springfield, Missouri, where weather is notoriously variable. So comparing the Brier scores of a Phoenix meteorologist with those of a Springfield meteorologist would be unfair. A 0.2 Brier score in Springfield could be a sign that you are a world-class meteorologist. It's a simple point with a big implication. Dredging up old forecasts from newspapers will seldom yield apples-to-apples comparisons because, outside of tournaments, real-world forecasters seldom predict exactly the same developments over exactly the same time period. Add it all up, and we are ready to roll. Like Archie Cochrane and other pioneers of evidence-based medicine, we must run carefully crafted experiments. Assemble forecasters. Ask them large numbers of questions with precise time frames and unambiguous language. Require that forecasts be expressed using numerical probability scales. And wait for time to pass. If the researchers have done their jobs, the results will be clear. The data can be analyzed and the key questions, how good are the forecasters, who are the best, what sets them apart, can be answered. Expert political judgment. That's what I set out to do in the mid-1980s. But I ran into rough spots early on. Despite my all but begging the highest profile pundits to take part, none would participate. Nonetheless, I managed to recruit 284 serious professionals, card-carrying experts whose livelihoods involved analyzing political and economic trends and events. Some were academics working in universities or think tanks. Others worked for branches of the U.S. government or for international organizations, such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or for the media. A small number were quite famous, others well-known in their professional communities, some early in their careers, and at that point quite obscure. But I still had to guarantee anonymity, because even experts who were not in the Tom Friedman elite class were reluctant to risk their reputations for zero professional payoff. Anonymity also ensured that participants would make their best guesses, uninfluenced by fear of embarrassment. The effects of public competition would have to wait for a future study. The first questions put to the experts were about themselves. Age, the average was 43. Relevant work experience, the average was 12.2 years. Education, almost all had postgraduate training, half had PhDs. We also asked about their ideological leanings and preferred approaches to solving political problems. Forecast questions covered time frames that ranged from 1 to 5 to 10 years out and tapped into diverse topics drawn from the news of the day, political and economic, domestic and international. They were asked about whatever topics experts could be found expanding on in the media and halls of power, which meant our experts would sometimes be asked to forecast in their zone of expertise, but more often not, which let us compare the accuracy of true subject matter experts with that of smart, well-informed laypeople. In total, our experts made roughly 28,000 predictions. Asking questions took years. Then came the waiting, a test of patience for even the tenured. I began the experiment when Mikhail Gorbachev and the Soviet Politburo were key players shaping the fate of the world. By the time I started to write up the results, the USSR existed only on historical maps, and Gorbachev was doing commercials for Pizza Hut. The final results appeared in 2005, 21 years, 6 presidential elections, and 3 wars after I sat on the National Research Council panel that got me thinking about forecasting. I published them in the academic treatise, Expert Political Judgment, How Good Is It? How Can We Know? To keep things simple, I'll call this whole research program EPJ. And the results. If you didn't know the punchline of EPJ before you read this book, you do now. The average expert was roughly as accurate as a dart-throwing chimpanzee. But as students are warned in the introductory statistics classes, averages can obscure. Hence the old joke about statisticians sleeping with their feet in an oven and their head in a freezer, because the average temperature is comfortable. In the EPJ results, there were 2 statistically distinguishable groups of experts. The first failed to do better than random guessing, and in their longer range forecasts even managed to lose to the chimp. The second group beat the chimp, though not by a wide margin, and they still had plenty of reasons to be humble. Indeed, they only barely beat simple algorithms like always predict no change or predict the recent rate of change. Still, however modest their foresight was, they had some. So why did one group do better than the other? It wasn't whether they had PhDs or access to classified information. Nor was it what they thought, whether they were liberals or conservatives, optimists or pessimists. The critical factor was how they thought. One group tended to organize their thinking around big ideas, although they didn't agree on which big ideas were true or false. Some were environmental doomsters. We're running out of everything. Others were cornucopia boomsters. We could find cost-effective substitutes for everything. Some were socialists, who favored state control of the commanding heights of the economy. Others were free market fundamentalists, who wanted to minimize regulation. As ideologically diverse as they were united by the fact that their thinking was so ideological. They sought to squeeze complex problems into the preferred cause-effect templates and treated what did not fit as irrelevant distractions. Allergic to wishy-washy answers, they kept pushing their analyses to the limit, and then some, using terms like furthermore and moreover, while piling up reasons why they were right and others wrong. As a result, they were unusually confident and likelier to declare things impossible or certain. Committed to their conclusions, they were reluctant to change their minds even when their predictions clearly failed. They would tell us, just wait. The other group consisted of more pragmatic experts who drew on many analytical tools, with a choice of tool hinging on the particular problem they faced. These experts gathered as much information from as many sources as they could. When thinking, they often shifted mental gears, sprinkling their speech with transition markers such as, however, but, although, and, on the other hand, they talked about possibilities and probabilities, not certainties. And while no one likes to say, I was wrong, these experts more readily admitted it and changed their minds. Decades ago, the philosopher Isaiah Berlin wrote a much acclaimed but rarely read essay that compared the styles of thinking of great authors through the ages. To organize his observations, he drew on a scrap of 2,500-year-old Greek poetry attributed to the warrior poet Archilochus. The fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. No one will ever know whether Archilochus was on the side of the fox or the hedgehog, but Berlin favored foxes. I felt no need to take sides. I just liked the metaphor because it captured something deep in my data. I dubbed the big idea experts hedgehogs, and the more eclectic experts, foxes. Foxes beat hedgehogs. And the foxes didn't just win by acting like chickens, playing it safe with 60% and 70% forecasts, where hedgehogs boldly went with 90% and 100%. Foxes beat hedgehogs on both calibration and resolution. Foxes had real foresight. Hedgehogs didn't. How did hedgehogs manage to do slightly worse than random guessing? To answer that question, let's meet a prototypic hedgehog. Larry Kudlow hosted a business talk show on CNBC and is a widely published pundit. But he got his start as an economist in the Reagan administration and later worked with Art Laffer, the economist whose theories were the cornerstone of Ronald Reagan's economic policies. Kudlow's one big idea is supply-side economics. When President George W. Bush followed the supply-side prescription by enacting substantial tax cuts, Kudlow was certain an economic boom of equal magnitude would follow. He dubbed it the Bush boom. Reality fell short. Growth and job creation were positive but somewhat disappointing relative to the long-term average, and particularly in comparison to that of the Clinton era, which began with a substantial tax hike. But Kudlow stuck to his guns and insisted year after year that the Bush boom was happening as forecast, even if commentators hadn't noticed. He called it the biggest story never told. In December 2007, months after the first rumblings of the financial crisis had been felt, the economy looked shaky, and many observers worried a recession was coming, or had even arrived. Kudlow was optimistic. "There is no recession," he wrote. "In fact, we are about to enter the seventh consecutive year of the Bush boom." The National Bureau of Economic Research later designated December 2007 as the official start of the Great Recession of 2007-09. As the months passed, the economy weakened and worries grew, but Kudlow did not budge. "There is no recession, and there will be no recession," he insisted. When the White House said the same in April 2008, Kudlow wrote, "President George W. Bush may turn out to be the top economic forecaster in the country." Through the spring and into the summer, the economy worsened, but Kudlow denied it. "We are in a mental recession, not an actual recession," he wrote, a theme he kept repeating until September 15th, when Lehman Brothers filed for bankruptcy. Wall Street was thrown into chaos, the global financial system froze, and people the world over felt like passengers in a plunging jet, eyes wide, fingers digging into armrests. How could Kudlow be so consistently wrong? Like all of us, hedgehog forecasters first see things from the tip-of-your-nose perspective. That's natural enough. But the hedgehog also knows one big thing. The big idea he uses over and over when trying to figure out what will happen next. Think of that big idea like a pair of glasses that the hedgehog never takes off. The hedgehog sees everything through those glasses. And they aren't ordinary glasses. They're green-tinted glasses, like the glasses that visitors to the Emerald City were required to wear in L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. Now, wearing green-tinted glasses may sometimes be helpful, in that they accentuate something real that might otherwise be overlooked. Maybe there is just a trace of green in a tablecloth that a naked eye might miss, or a subtle shade of green in running water. But far more often, green-tinted glasses distort reality. Everywhere you look, you see green, whether it's there or not. And very often, it's not. The Emerald City wasn't even emerald in the fable. People only thought it was because they were forced to wear green-tinted glasses. So the hedgehog's one big idea doesn't improve his foresight. It distorts it. And more information doesn't help, because it's all seen through the same tinted glasses. It may increase the hedgehog's confidence, but not his accuracy. That's a bad combination. The predictable result? When the hedgehogs and the EPJ research made forecasts on the subjects they knew the most about, their own specialties, their accuracy declined. The American economy is Larry Kudlow's beat. But in 2008, when it was increasingly obvious that it was in trouble, he didn't see what others did. He couldn't. Everything looked green to him. Not that being wrong hurt Kudlow's career. In January 2009, with the American economy in a crisis worse than any since the Great Depression, Kudlow's new show, The Kudlow Report, premiered on CNBC. That too was consistent with the EPJ data, which revealed an inverse correlation between fame and accuracy. The more famous an expert was, the less accurate he was. That's not because editors, producers, and the public go looking for bad forecasters. They go looking for hedgehogs, who just happen to be bad forecasters. Animated by a big idea, hedgehogs tell tight, simple, clear stories that grab and hold audiences. As anyone who has done media training knows, the first rule is, keep it simple, stupid. Better still, hedgehogs are confident. With their one-perspective analysis, hedgehogs can pile up reasons why they are right. Furthermore, moreover, without considering other perspectives and the pesky doubts and caveats they raise. And so, as EPJ showed, hedgehogs are likelier to say something definitely will or won't happen. For many audiences, that's satisfying. People tend to find uncertainty disturbing, and maybe underscores uncertainty with a bright red crayon. The simplicity and confidence of the hedgehog impairs foresight, but it calms nerves, which is good for the careers of hedgehogs. Foxes don't fare so well in the media. They're less confident, less likely to say something is certain or impossible, and are likelier to settle on shades of maybe. And their stories are complex, full of howevers and, on the other hands, because they look at problems one way, then another, and another. This aggregation of many perspectives is bad TV, but it's good forecasting. Indeed, it's essential. Dragonfly Eye. In 1906, the legendary British scientist, Sir Francis Galton, went to a country fair and watched as hundreds of people individually guessed the weight that a live ox would be after it was slaughtered and dressed. Their average guess, their collective judgment, was 1,197 pounds. 1 pound short of the correct answer, 1,198 pounds. It was the earliest demonstration of a phenomenon popularized by, and now named for, James Sirwicky's bestseller, The Wisdom of Crowds. Aggregating the judgment of many consistently beats the accuracy of the average member of the group and is often as startlingly accurate as Galton's weight guessers. The collective judgment isn't always more accurate than any individual guess, however. In fact, in any group, there are likely to be individuals who beat the group. But those bullseye guesses typically say more about the power of luck. Chimps who throw a lot of darts will get occasional bullseyes, than about the skill of the guesser. That becomes clear when the exercise is repeated many times. There will be individuals who beat the group in each repetition, but they will tend to be different individuals. Beating the average consistently requires rare skill. Some reverently call it the miracle of aggregation, but it is easy to demystify. The key is recognizing that useful information is often dispersed widely, with one person possessing a scrap, another holding a more important piece, a third having a few bits, and so on. When Galton watched people guessing the weight of the doomed ox, he was watching them translate whatever information they had into a number. When a butcher looked at the ox, he contributed the information he possessed thanks to years of training and experience. When a man who regularly bought meat at the butcher store made his guess, he added a little more. A third person who remembered how much the ox weighed at last year's fair did the same. And so it went. Hundreds of people added valid information, creating a collective pool far greater than any one of them possessed. Of course, they also contributed myths and mistakes, creating a pool of misleading clues as big as the pool of useful clues. But there was an important difference between the two pools. All the valid information pointed in one direction, toward 1,198 pounds. but the errors had different sources and pointed in different directions. Some suggested the correct answer was higher, some lower. So they canceled each other out. With valid information piling up and errors nullifying themselves, the net result was an astonishingly accurate estimate. How well aggregation works depends on what you are aggregating. Aggregating the judgments of many people who know nothing produces a lot of nothing. Aggregating the judgments of people who know a little is better, and if there are enough of them, it can produce impressive results. But aggregating the judgments of an equal number of people who know lots about lots of different things is most effective because the collective pool of information becomes much bigger. Aggregations of aggregations can also yield impressive results. A well-conducted opinion survey aggregates a lot of information about voter intentions, but combining surveys, a poll of polls, turns many information pools into one big pool. That's the core of what Nate Silver, Sam Wang, and other statisticians did in the presidential election of 2012. And a poll of polls can be further aggregated with other data sources. PolyVote is a project of an academic consortium that forecasts presidential elections by aggregating diverse sources, including election polls, the judgments of a panel of political experts, and quantitative models developed by political scientists. In operation since the 1990s, it has a strong record, often sticking with the eventual winner when the polls turn and the experts change their minds. Now look at how Fox's approach forecasting. They deploy not one analytical idea, but many, and seek out information not from one source, but many. Then they synthesize it all into a single conclusion. In a word, they aggregate. They may be individuals working alone, but what they do is, in principle, no different from what Galton's crowd did. They integrate perspectives and the information contained within them. The only real difference is that the process occurs within one skull. But doing this sort of inside-your-head aggregation can be challenging. Consider a guess-the-number game in which players must guess a number between 0 and 100. The person whose guess comes closest to 2/3 of the average guess of all contestants wins. That's it. And imagine there is a prize. The reader who comes closest to the correct answer wins a pair of business class tickets for a flight between London and New York. The Financial Times actually held this contest in 1997 at the urging of Richard Thaler, a pioneer of behavioral economics. If I were reading the Financial Times in 1997, how would I win those tickets? I might start by thinking that because anyone can guess anything between 0 and 100, the guesses will be scattered randomly. That would make the average guess 50, and 2/3 of 50 is 33. So I should guess 33. At this point, I'm feeling pretty pleased with myself. I'm sure I've nailed it. But before I say, final answer, I pause. Think about the other contestants, and it dawns on me that they went through the same thought process as I did, which means they all guessed 33 too, which means the average guess is not 50, it's 33, and 2/3 of 33 is 22. So my first conclusion was actually wrong. I should guess 22. Now I'm feeling very clever indeed. But wait. The other contestants also thought about the other contestants just as I did, which means they would have all guessed 22, which means the average guess is actually 22, and 2/3 of 22 is about 15. So I should... See where this is going? Because the contestants are aware of each other and aware that they are aware, the number is going to keep shrinking until it hits the point where it can no longer shrink. That point is zero. So that's my final answer, and I will surely win. My logic is airtight, and I happen to be one of those highly educated people who is familiar with game theory, so I know zero is called the Nash Equilibrium Solution, QED. The only question is who will come with me to London. Guess what? I'm wrong. In the actual contest, some people did guess zero, but not many. And zero was not the right answer. It wasn't even close to right. The average guess of all the contestants was 18.91, so the winning guess was 13. How did I get this so wrong? It wasn't my logic, which was sound. I failed because I only looked at the problem from one perspective, the perspective of logic. Who are the other contestants? Are they all the sort of people who would think about this carefully, spot the logic, and pursue it relentlessly to the final answer of zero? If they were Vulcans, certainly. But they are humans. Maybe we can assume that Financial Times readers are a tad smarter than the general public and better puzzle solvers, but they can't all be perfectly rational. Surely some of them will be cognitively lazy and fail to realize that the other contestants are working through the problem just as they are. They will settle on 33 as their final answer. Maybe some others will spot the logic and get to 22, but they may not keep thinking, so they will stop there. And that's just what happened. 33 and 22 were the most popular answers. And because I did not think about the problem from this different perspective and factor it into my own judgment, I was wrong. What I should have done is look at the problem from both perspectives, the perspectives of both logic and psychologic, and combine what I saw. And this merging of perspectives need not be limited to two. In Thaler's Guess the Number game, we might easily imagine a third perspective and use it to further improve our judgment. The first perspective is that of the rational Vulcan. The second is that of the sometimes rational but a little lazy human. A third perspective would be that of contestants who identify the first two perspectives and aggregate them to make their guess. In the original Star Trek TV series, Mr. Spock was the unflappably logical Vulcan, Dr. McCoy was the hot-headed human, and Captain Kirk was the synthesis of the two. In the Guess the Number game, Spock's answer would have been zero, McCoy's would have been 33, or maybe 22, and Captain Kirk would have considered them both. So we could call this the Captain Kirk perspective. If there are only a few Captain Kirks among the contestants, their responses may not shift the math much. But if there are more, their sophisticated thinking may make a significant difference, and it would improve our answer, at least a little, if we could factor that third perspective into our own judgment. It would not be easy. This is getting complicated, and the gradations of judgment required, should the final guess be 10 or 11 or 12, are fine-grained. But sometimes these fine distinctions are the difference between good and great, as we will see later with the super forecasters. And there is no reason to stop at three or four perspectives, although in the Guess the Number game, that's about as far as it is practical to go. In other contexts, a fourth, fifth, and sixth perspective can further sharpen a judgment. In theory, there is no limit. So the best metaphor for this process is the vision of the dragonfly. Like us, dragonflies have two eyes, but theirs are constructed very differently. Each eye is an enormous, bulging sphere, the surface of which is covered with tiny lenses. Depending on the species, there may be as many as 30,000 of these lenses on a single eye, each one occupying a physical space slightly different from those of the adjacent lenses, giving it a unique perspective. Information from these thousands of unique perspectives flows into the dragonfly's brain, where it is synthesized into vision so superb that the dragonfly can see in almost every direction simultaneously, with the clarity and precision it needs to pick off flying insects at high speed. A fox with the bulging eyes of a dragonfly is an ugly mixed metaphor, but it captures a key reason why the foresight of foxes is superior to that of hedgehogs, with their green-tinted glasses. Foxes aggregate perspectives. Unfortunately, aggregation doesn't come to us naturally. The tip of your nose perspective insists that it sees reality objectively and correctly, so there is no need to consult other perspectives. All too often, we agree. We don't consider alternative views, even when it's clear that we should. This is painfully obvious at a poker table. Even weak players know, in principle, that seeing through the eyes of opponents is critical. She raised the bet $20. What does that tell me about her thinking and the card she has? Each bet is another clue to what your opponent is holding, or wants you to think she is holding, and the only way to piece it together is to imagine yourself in her seat. Good perspective takers can make a lot of money. So you might suppose that anyone who takes poker seriously would get good at it, quickly, or take up another hobby. and yet they so often don't. Here's a very simple example, says Annie Duke, an elite professional poker player, winner of the World Series of Poker, and a former PhD-level student of psychology. Everyone who plays poker knows you can either fold, call, or raise a bet. So what will happen is that when a player who isn't an expert sees another player raise, they automatically assume that that player is strong, as if the size of the bet is somehow correlated at one with the strength of the other person's hand. This is a mistake. Duke teaches poker, and to get her students to see like dragonflies, she walks them through a game situation. A hand is dealt. You like your cards. In the first of several rounds of betting, you wager a certain amount. The other player immediately raises your bet substantially. Now what do you think the other player has? Duke has taught thousands of students, and universally they say, I think they have a really strong hand. So then she asks them to imagine the same situation, except they're playing against her. The cards are dealt. Their hand is more than strong, it's unbeatable. Duke makes her bet. Now, what will you do? Will you raise her bet? And they say to me, well, no. If they raise, Duke may conclude their hand is strong and fold. They don't want to scare her off. They want Duke to stay in for each of the rounds of betting, so they can expand the pot as much as possible before they scoop it up. So they won't raise. They'll only call. Duke then walks them through the same hypothetical, with a hand that is beatable, but still very strong. Will you raise? No. How about a little weaker hand that is still a likely winner? No raise. They would never raise with any of these really great hands, because they don't want to chase me away. Then Duke asks them, why did you assume that an opponent who raises the bet has a strong hand, if you would not raise with the same strong hand? And it's not until I walk them through the exercise, Duke says, that people realize they failed to truly look at the table from the perspective of their opponent. If Duke's students were all vacationing retirees, trying poker for the first time, this would only tell us that dilettantes tend to be naive, but these are people who have played enough poker and are passionate about the game and consider themselves good enough that they're paying $1,000 for a seminar with me, Duke says. And they don't understand this basic concept. Stepping outside ourselves and really getting a different view of reality is a struggle. But foxes are likelier to give it a try. Whether by virtue of temperament or habit or conscious effort, they tend to engage in the hard work of consulting other perspectives. But remember the old reflexivity paradox joke. There are two types of people in the world, those who think there are two types and those who don't. I'm of the second type. My fox-hedgehog model is not a dichotomy. It is a spectrum. In EPJ, my analyses extended to what I called hybrids, fox-hedgehogs, who are foxes a little closer to the hedgehog end of the spectrum, and hedgehog foxes, who are hedgehogs with a little foxiness. But even expanding the categories to four doesn't capture people's styles of thinking. People can and do think differently in different circumstances. Cool and calculating at work, perhaps, but intuitive and impulsive when shopping. And our thinking habits are not immutable. Sometimes they evolve without our awareness of the change. But we can also, with effort, choose to shift gears from one mode to another. No model captures the richness of human nature. Models are supposed to simplify things, which is why even the best are flawed. But they're necessary. Our minds are full of models. We couldn't function without them. And we often function pretty well because some of our models are decent approximations of reality. All models are wrong, the statistician George Box observed, but some are useful. The fox-hedgehog model is a starting point, not the end. Forget the dart-throwing chimp punchline. What matters is that EPJ found modest but real foresight, and the critical ingredient was the style of thinking. The next step was figuring out how to advance that insight. Chapter 4. Super Forecasters. We judge that Iraq has continued its weapons of mass destruction, WMD programs, in defiance of UN resolutions and restrictions. Baghdad has chemical and biological weapons, as well as missiles with ranges in excess of UN restrictions. If left unchecked, it probably will have a nuclear weapon during this decade. The language is flat, but that opening was a grabber when it was released to the public in October 2002. Terrorists had committed the 9/11 atrocities 13 months earlier. The United States had invaded Afghanistan to oust the Taliban, who had harbored Osama bin Laden. Then the administration of George W. Bush turned its attention to Saddam Hussein's Iraq, suggesting that Iraq had ties to Al-Qaeda, that Iraq was behind 9/11, that Iraq was a menace to other countries in the Middle East and the oil that flowed from the region, that Iraq had not destroyed its WMDs as required by the United Nations, that it was building up its stockpiles and was becoming more dangerous by the day. Saddam Hussein had, or would soon have, the ability to hit Europe, the White House claimed, and even the United States. Critics responded that the administration had long ago decided to invade Iraq and was exaggerating the threat by using vivid language. "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud," in Condoleezza Rice's words, to gin up support for its war. That was when National Intelligence Estimate 2002, 16HC, was released. National intelligence estimates are the consensus views of the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and 13 other agencies. Collectively, these agencies are known as the Intelligence Community, or IC. The exact numbers are classified, but by one rough estimate, the IC has a budget of more than $50 billion and employs 100,000 people. Of these, 20,000 are intelligence analysts, whose job is not to collect information, but to make sense of what is collected and judge its implications for national security. And this fantastically elaborate, expensive, and experienced intelligence apparatus concluded in October 2002 that the key claims of the Bush administration about Iraqi WMDs were correct. Many people found that persuasive. The job of intelligence is to speak truth to power, not to tell the politicians temporarily in charge what they want to hear. So, for them, the NIE settled the matter. It was now a fact that Saddam Hussein had active WMD programs churning out deadly weapons, and the threat was growing. What to do about these facts was another question, but only those blinded by politics would deny them. Even caustic critics of the Bush administration, people like Tom Friedman, who derisively called them Bushies, were convinced Saddam Hussein was hiding something somewhere. We now know that these facts were false. After invading in 2003, the United States turned Iraq upside down looking for WMDs, but found nothing. It was one of the worst, arguably the worst, intelligence failure in modern history. The IC was humiliated. There were condemnations in the media, official investigations, and the familiar ritual of intelligence officials sitting in hearings, faces sweaty, expressions grim, as congressional committees took turns tearing into them. What went wrong? One explanation was that the IC had caved to White House bullying. The intelligence had been politicized. But official investigations rejected that claim. So did Robert Jervis, a fact I found more compelling because Jervis has a four-decade track record of insightful, nonpartisan scholarship about intelligence. Jervis is the author of Why Intelligence Fails, which meticulously dissects both the failure of the IC to foresee the Iranian Revolution in 1979, Jervis conducted a postmortem for the CIA that was classified for decades, and the false alarm on Saddam Hussein's WMDs. In the latter case, the IC's conclusion was sincere, Jervis decided, and it was reasonable. But the conclusion wasn't reasonable, you may think. It was wrong. That reaction is totally understandable. But it too was wrong. Remember, the question is not, was the IC's judgment correct? It is, was the IC's judgment reasonable? Answering that question requires putting ourselves in the position of the people making the judgment at the time, which means looking at only the information available then. And that evidence was sufficient to lead virtually every major intelligence agency on the planet to suspect, with varying confidence, that Saddam was hiding something. Not because they had glimpsed what he was hiding, but because Saddam was acting like someone who was hiding something. What other explanation could there be for playing a game of hide-and-seek with UN arms inspectors that risks triggering an invasion and your own downfall? But few things are harder than mental time travel. Even for historians, putting yourself in the position of someone at the time, and not being swayed by your knowledge of what happened later, is a struggle. So the question, was the IC's judgment reasonable, is challenging. But it's a snap to answer, was the IC's judgment correct? As I noted in Chapter 2, a situation like that tempts us with a bait and switch. Replace the tough question with the easy one, answer it, and then sincerely believe that we have answered the tough question. This particular bait and switch, replacing, was it a good decision, with, did it have a good outcome, is both popular and pernicious. Savvy poker players see this mistake as a beginner's blunder. A novice may overestimate the probability that the next card will win her the hand. Bet big, get lucky and win. But winning doesn't retroactively make her foolish bet wise. Conversely, a pro may correctly see that there is a high probability of winning the hand, bet big, get unlucky, and lose. But that doesn't mean her bet was unwise. Good poker players, investors, and executives all understand this. If they don't, they can't remain good at what they do, because they will draw false lessons from experience, making their judgment worse over time. So it's not oxymoronic to conclude, as Robert Jervis did, that the intelligence community's conclusion was both reasonable and wrong. But, and this is key, Jervis did not let the intelligence community off the hook. There were not only errors, but correctable ones, he wrote about the IC's analysis. Analysis could and should have been better. Would that have made a difference? In a sense, no. The result would have been to make the intelligence assessments less certain, rather than to reach a fundamentally different conclusion. So the IC would still have concluded that Saddam had WMDs. They just would have been much less confident in that conclusion. That may sound like a gentle criticism. In fact, it's devastating, because a less confident conclusion from the IC may have made a huge difference. If some in Congress had set the bar at beyond a reasonable doubt for supporting the invasion, then a 60% or 70% estimate that Saddam was churning out weapons of mass destruction would not have satisfied them. The congressional resolution authorizing the use of force might not have passed, and the United States might not have invaded. Stakes rarely get much higher than thousands of lives and trillions of dollars. But NIE 2002-16HC didn't say 60% or 70%. It said, Iraq has. Baghdad has. Statements like these admit no possibility of surprise. They are the equivalent of, the sun rises in the east and sets in the west. At a White House briefing on December 12, 2002, the CIA director, George Tenet, used the phrase, slam dunk. He later protested that the quote had been taken out of context, but that doesn't matter here because slam dunk did indeed sum up the IC's attitude. And that was unusual. Intelligence analysis always involves uncertainty, often big dollops of it. Analysts know that. Yet on Iraqi WMDs, the IC fell prey to hubris. As a result, it wasn't merely wrong. It was wrong when it said it couldn't be wrong. Postmortems even revealed that the IC had never seriously explored the idea that it could be wrong. There were no red teams to attack the prevailing views, no analyses from devil's advocates, no papers that provided competing possibilities, Jervis wrote. Most strikingly, no one proposed a view close to the one we now believe to be true. As the presidential investigation of the debacle tartly noted, failing to conclude that Saddam had ended his banned weapons program is one thing. Not even considering it as a possibility is another. The IC is a huge bureaucracy that responds slowly even to the shock of major failures. Jervis told me that after he finished his postmortem on the 1979 failure to foresee the Iranian Revolution, the biggest geopolitical disaster of that era, I saw the head of the CIA Office of Political Analysis, and she said, I know you haven't heard anything from us, and that must confirm all your concerns, but we're going to have this big meeting and analysis, and discussion with you. And that is the end of the story. It never happened. The shock of the WMD failure was different. The bureaucracy was shaken to its foundation. They took that to heart, Jervis said. In 2006, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, IARPA, was created. Its mission is to fund cutting-edge research with the potential to make the intelligence community smarter and more effective. As its name suggests, IARPA was modeled after DARPA, the famous defense agency whose military-related research has had a huge influence on the modern world. DARPA's work even contributed to the invention of the Internet. In 2008, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which sits atop the entire network of 16 intelligence agencies, asked the National Research Council to form a committee. The task was to synthesize research on good judgment and help the IC put that research to good use. By Washington standards, it was a bold, or rash, thing to do. It's not every day that a bureaucracy pays one of the world's most respected scientific institutions to produce an objective report that might conclude that the bureaucracy is clueless. Distinguished scientists from a range of disciplines sat on the committee, which was chaired by the psychologist Baruch Fischoff. I was in the room too, probably because of the controversy I stirred up with the Can You Beat the Dart-Throwing Chimp Challenge in my 2005 book, Expert Political Judgment. 2 years later, we delivered a report that was 100% Archie Cochrane. Don't believe until you test. The IC should not rely on analytical methods that violate well-documented behavioral principles, or that have no evidence of efficacy beyond their intuitive appeal, the report noted. The IC should rigorously test current and proposed methods under conditions that are as realistic as possible. Such an evidence-based approach to analysis will promote the continuous learning needed to keep the IC smarter and more agile than the nation's adversaries. It's a simple idea, but, as was true in medicine for so long, it is routinely overlooked. For example, the CIA gives its analysts a manual written by Richard Huer, a former analyst, that lays out relevant insights from psychology, including biases that can trip up an analyst's thinking. It's fine work. And it makes sense that giving analysts a basic grasp of psychology will help them avoid cognitive traps and thus help produce better judgments. But does it? No one knows. It has never been tested. Some analysts think the training is so intuitively compelling that it doesn't need to be tested. Sound familiar? Even the $50 billion question, how accurate are the forecasts of intelligence analysts, can't be answered. Of course, some think they know. Senior officials may claim that the IC is right 80% or 90% of the time. But these are just guesses. Like the 19th century physicians, who were sure that their treatments cured patients 80% or 90% of the time, they may be right, or close to right, or very wrong. Absent accuracy metrics, there is no meaningful way to hold intelligence analysts accountable for accuracy. Note the word meaningful in the last sentence. When the Director of National Intelligence is dragged into Congress for a blown call, that is accountability for accuracy. It may be ill-informed or capricious and serve no purpose beyond political grandstanding, but it is accountability. By contrast, meaningful accountability requires more than getting upset when something goes awry. It requires systematic tracking of accuracy, for all the reasons laid out earlier. But the intelligence community's forecasts have never been systematically assessed. What there is instead is accountability for process. Intelligence analysts are told what they are expected to do when researching, thinking, and judging, and then held accountable to those standards. Did you consider alternative hypotheses? Did you look for contrary evidence? It's sensible stuff. But the point of making forecasts is not to tick all the boxes on the How to Make Forecasts checklist. It is to foresee what's coming. To have accountability for process, but not accuracy, is like ensuring that physicians wash their hands, examine the patient, and consider all the symptoms, but never checking to see whether the treatment works. The intelligence community is not alone in operating this way. The list of organizations that produce or buy forecasts without bothering to check for accuracy is astonishing. But thanks to the shock of the Iraqi WMD debacle, and the prodding of the National Research Council report, and the efforts of some dedicated civil servants, the IC decided to do something about it. Or more precisely, IARPA decided. The Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity is an agency few outside the intelligence community have heard of, and for good reason. IARPA doesn't have spies doing cloak and dagger work or analysts who interpret information. Its job is to identify and support high-risk, high-payoff research with the potential to improve the IC's capabilities. That makes IARPA similar to DARPA, but DARPA is much more famous because it's bigger, has been around longer, and often funds whiz-bang technology. Most intelligence research isn't so exotic, and yet it can be just as important to national security. In the summer of 2010, two IARPA officials, Jason Matheny and Steve Reber, visited Berkeley. Barbara Mellers and I met them at a hotel with a tourist trap view of San Francisco, where they gave us news as pleasant as the vista. They planned to act on the key recommendations in the National Research Council report, a recommendation I had confidently predicted would gather dust. IARPA would sponsor a massive tournament to see who could invent the best methods of making the sorts of forecasts that intelligence analysts make every day. Will the president of Tunisia flee to a cushy exile in the next month? Will an outbreak of H5N1 in China kill more than 10 in the next 6 months? Will the euro fall below $1.20 in the next 12 months? IARPA was looking for questions in the Goldilocks zone of difficulty, neither so easy that any attentive reader of the New York Times could get them right, nor so hard that no one on the planet could. IARPA saw this Goldilocks zone as the best place both for finding new forecasting talent and for testing new methods of cultivating talent. The proposed tournament would be, by design, quite different from my earlier EPJ tournament. The longest questions would usually be shorter than my shortest questions. IARPA didn't want to waste money pushing people to do what we now know to be pretty much impossible. Human visual systems will never be able to read the bottom line off Snellen eye exam charts 100 meters away, and exercising your eye muscles from now until eternity won't change that. And as EPJ and other studies have shown, human cognitive systems will never be able to forecast turning points in the lives of individuals or nations several years into the future. And heroic searches for super forecasters won't change that. IARPA's plan was to create tournament-style incentives for top researchers to generate accurate probability estimates for Goldilocks zone questions. The research teams would compete against one another and an independent control group. Teams had to beat the combined forecast, the wisdom of the crowd, of the control group, and by margins we all saw as intimidating. In the first year, IARPA wanted teams to beat that standard by 20%, and it wanted that margin of victory to grow to 50% by the fourth year. But that was only part of IARPA's plan. Within each team, researchers could run Archie Cochrane-style experiments to assess what really works against internal control groups. Researchers might think, for example, that giving forecasters a basic training exercise would improve their accuracy. But if they simply trained all forecasters, what would it prove? If forecasters' accuracy rose, it might be because the training worked. Or maybe the questions got easier. Or maybe the forecasters just got lucky. If accuracy fell, it might be because the training was counterproductive, or perhaps accuracy would have declined even more but for the training. There would be no way to know. Recognize the problem? It's the one physicians face throughout the history of medicine. Archie Cochrane saw the solution. Quit pretending you know things you don't and start running experiments. Give the training to one randomly chosen group of forecasters, but not another. Keep all else constant. Compare results. If the trainees become more accurate, while the untrained don't, the training worked. The research possibilities were limited only by imagination, but to exploit them we needed a lot of forecasters. My colleagues and I put out the word through blogs and professional networks. Do you want to forecast the world's future? Here's your chance. And you won't even have to leave home. Just spend a little time each day thinking about political economic puzzles and make your best guesses. Our recruitment efforts were rewarded. In the first year, several thousand volunteers signed up, and roughly 3,200 passed through our initial gauntlet of psychometric tests and started forecasting. We called our research team and program the Good Judgment Project. A project on this scale costs many millions of dollars a year. But that's not what made it bureaucratically gutsy for IARPA to do this. After all, the intelligence community's annual budget is around $50 billion, which is more than most countries' annual gross domestic product. Next to that mountain of cash, the cost of the IARPA tournament was an anthill. No, what made it gutsy was what it could reveal. Here's one possible revelation. Imagine you get a couple hundred ordinary people to forecast geopolitical events. You see how often they revise their forecasts, and how accurate those forecasts prove to be, and use that information to identify the 40 or so who are the best. Then you have everyone make lots more forecasts. This time you calculate the average forecast of the whole group, the wisdom of the crowd, but with extra weight given to those 40 top forecasters. Then you give the forecast a final tweak. You extremize it, meaning you push it closer to 100% or zero. If the forecast is 70%, you might bump it up to, say, 85%. If it's 30%, you might reduce it to 15%. Now imagine that the forecasts you produce this way beat those of every other group and method available, often by large margins. Your forecasts even beat those of professional intelligence analysts inside the government who have access to classified information, by margins that remain classified. Think how shocking it would be to the intelligence professionals who have spent their lives forecasting geopolitical events to be beaten by a few hundred ordinary people and some simple algorithms. It actually happened. What I've described is the method we use to win IARPA's tournament. There is nothing dazzlingly innovative about it. Even the extremizing tweak is based on a pretty simple insight. When you combine the judgments of a large group of people to calculate the wisdom of the crowd, you collect all the relevant information that is dispersed among all those people. But none of those people has access to all that information. One person knows only some of it, another knows some more, and so on. What would happen if every one of those people were given all the information? They would become more confident, raising their forecasts closer to 100% or zero. If you then calculate the wisdom of the crowd, it too would be more extreme. Of course, it's impossible to give every person all the relevant information, so we extremize to simulate what would happen if we could. Thanks to IARPA, we now know a few hundred ordinary people, and some simple math, can not only compete with professionals supported by a multi-billion dollar apparatus, but also beat them. And that's just one of the unsettling revelations IARPA's decision made possible. What if the tournament discovered ordinary people who could, without the assistance of any algorithmic magic, beat the IC? Imagine how threatening that would be. With his gray beard, thinning hair, and glasses, Doug Lorch doesn't look like a threat to anyone. He looks like a computer programmer, which he was for IBM. He is retired now. He lives in a quiet neighborhood in Santa Barbara with his wife, an artist who paints lovely watercolors. His Facebook avatar is a duck. Doug likes to drive his little red convertible Miata around the sunny streets, enjoying the California breeze, but that can only occupy so many hours in the day. Doug has no special expertise in international affairs, but he has a healthy curiosity about what's happening. He reads the New York Times. He can find Kazakhstan on a map. So he volunteered for the Good Judgment Project. Once a day, for an hour or so, his dining room table became his forecasting center, where he opened his laptop, read the news, and tried to anticipate the fate of the world. In the first year, Doug answered 104 questions like, will Serbia be officially granted European Union candidacy by 31st December 2011? And, will the London gold market fixing price of gold USD per ounce, exceed $1,850 on 30th September 2011? That's a lot of forecasting, but it understates what Doug did. In my EPJ research, I had asked experts to make only one forecast per question and scored it later. By contrast, the IARPA tournament encouraged forecasters to update their forecasts and